It's October here at AZMcast, and we have been wasting time. Jared and I tried some new audio stuff that ended up being not the right decision. Anyway, we've wasted your time all this October, but we will get it out in time, and we are going to start with some of our conference recaps. You guys can hear the awesome stuff we're doing at university and South Campus conferences. Jared and I are going to talk about a case that will blow your freaking mind. We're going to have a discussion about the ARISE trial, sepsis in general, and a case of sepsis with a twist. And then Ryan Wyatt, one of our paramedic extraordinaires, is going to tell us what we should do if you're ever involved in an emergency outside of the emergency department. We've got great stuff for you. We hope you enjoy. Let's quit wasting time and get to the AZM casting. Hi, Allie.
Hi, Aaron.
So we are going to cover some of the stuff that happened during the university campus conferences, some of the highlights that you guys should go back and look at, and some of the cool things we got to do. One of the coolest things that we have the good fortune of having is we have Peter Rosen, who's basically synonymous with emergency medicine. He's got a textbook named after him. He's got most of the founding residencies where he's a professor emeritus, and we're lucky enough to have him now spend most of his time in great sunny Tucson. And he comes to our conferences and just drops knowledge and goes over crazy cases in his wonderful Rosen irreverent way, and really has some well thought out, in-depth discussions about very tough to discuss issues.
Yeah, he's great. I think we try to get him in conference as often as we can. He does a lot of traveling now, actually, but luckily he's here frequently, and we love to hear him talk. He has tons of wisdom and experience, has some really good pearls about how to practice emergency medicine, and some really awesome dirty jokes.
We were talking about having some of his talks on the podcast, but this is intended for families, so we probably can't republish that. So if you see him on the schedule, you gotta go. It's just fascinating, and we're very fortunate to be able to have somebody who has this much experience and knowledge of emergency medicine. Just kind of tell it like it is. It's very cool. We also did, Kevin Riley did a fantastic lecture on EKGs. Went through some of the basics, talked about dysrhythmias, talked about what you're looking for with these dysrhythmias.
Yeah, those EKG lectures are always super helpful. Breaks it down, kind of gives you what looks ugly and what doesn't, and what you should really be honing in on.
I really feel like when you've seen one EKG, you've seen one EKG. Mm-hmm. And trying to differentiate what's normal from not, and then what's not normal from what's dangerous, is even harder. And Kevin does a great job. So I'd go back and watch that lecture if you guys weren't there.
For sure. And then we had a whole day of core content / sim. We did pulmonary emergencies. Noah Tolby gave a great core content lecture, followed by a sim and ultrasound combined session. Those are always super helpful, really good topics that they put together, good skills. That was a cool day. Mm-hmm. Then we had our first foam conference. We've been talking a lot about foam and foam parties, and we put together just sort of the first of hopefully a series of lectures focusing on this. Sam Keim was there on the panel talking about sort of the idea of foam and how that fits into evidence-based medicine, and what you should really, how you should be using it really in your practice, and kind of questioning authority was really his message, which I think is a good one.
He's a big proponent of you got to let the literature and the data say what it says. Even people that are well-respected, have lots of experience, you listen to what they say, and then you look at the data, because medicine changes, especially emergency medicine. I thought he had a very interesting insight into foam, and we try to preach that a lot on here as well, is don't just take our word for it. Go look it up. We also had a great grand rounds by Rad.
Yeah, she said it was going to be R-rated, but I think it was actually more PG-13.
It's R-rated for Rad.
But it was pretty good. She did a good review of psychiatric emergencies and how we as emergency physicians actually, I mean, we really need to know how to handle those patients and those difficult situations that sometimes are not very comfortable and things that we're not familiar with. And I think she did a great job going over the literature and strategies on how to effectively take care of those patients.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have psychiatry in-house at any given time. And just, well, anybody that acts up, give them some Haldol and benzodiazepines. But going out on your own where that's not always the case, I thought that was very good.
Yeah.
And then we were fortunate to have one of our joint conferences. So we had a head subspecialty day, head and chest.
Boobs.
Allie, we had Dr. Rosen come again and give us some more pearls of wisdom that were great. And then we had Dave Perry, who's one of our ear, nose, and throat docs. I love Dave Perry. I have an academic crush on him. And he talked about some of the scary and common things. He talked about airway foreign bodies. He talked about peritonsillar and retropharyngeal abscesses. He talked about ear and nose foreign bodies. And everyone's favorite, the dreaded epistaxis. There were a couple things to take away, and he actually sent me an email to cover some of the stuff that he had said that he wanted to impress. First thing he wanted to say is that he loves our residents and our docs. He loves coming into our ED because he knows that we've taken good care of our patients. The other thing that he had noted, one thing was about epistaxis. He did a little bit of a mini lit review to see what's updated. What he wanted to put across is that hypertension is not the causal issue for epistaxis. You don't necessarily get hypertensive and then start bleeding furiously out of your nose, but it sure doesn't help things. I've had a couple patients that were like GSWs to the head that when they start getting agitated, they start spurting blood out of their ear or something because it's a high pressure system. So hypertension doesn't help. I think what we were probably trying to say from the emergency side is, yeah, but come down and help me out while I'm trying to get the hypertension down, because eventually I can get the blood pressure so low that nothing's bleeding anywhere. And now we haven't helped anybody. So it was a little bit of a love-hate relationship with hypertension and nosebleeds, but I think we can work together. I think we need to try to get the blood pressure controlled, get the pain controlled, get the freaking out controlled, and then hopefully have our ENT colleagues come down. I also really liked what he said about peritonsillar abscesses.
Yeah, I think he had some great tips about how to approach these. I think the first thing as far as exam is concerned, he really stressed that trismus is something that you really have to, that is really sensitive and specific, he said, for a peritonsillar abscess as opposed to just a really bad tonsillitis. And as far as his techniques, headlight is what we should all be using and would really would make our lives easier. He also had, I think, a good diagram of the four spots he likes to try to aspirate for peritonsillar abscesses, and I thought that was really helpful. And then using a 5 ml syringe as opposed to a 10 cc syringe that might, it's smaller and a little more maneuverable in somebody who can't open their mouth very wide anyway. Becca gave a great talk. You know, I don't know about you, but whenever people come in presenting with a breast mass, I kind of don't know what to do with them other than try to reassure them and give them some resources, and often I don't even know where to send them. So I think having Becca there to talk about, you know, what she recommends. She talked about breast abscesses and doing needle aspiration and then gave, I think, some really good resources to send people when they have boob problems. The day started, though, over at the ophthalmology clinic, which I think was really well done. The ophthalmology department really took the lead and coordinated that whole morning, and I thought that was great. They gave a little lecture on the common presentations that we'll see regarding eye problems, and then some really good skill sessions about describing the anatomy of the eye, using the slit lamp in a somewhat competent way, and then getting more accurate pressures with those blasted tonal pens.
I thought error was an appropriate pressure. It's enough to say, yeah, there's something wrong. You should probably come in.
Yeah.
It's reading error.
Or Cal. What's Cal mean? Yeah, so I think that whole day was really helpful, and I think it was awesome.
We were very grateful to get to work well with our subspecialty colleagues, especially the stuff that we don't do a whole lot, that we don't feel comfortable with. Getting to work with these people during residency and how is an attending and getting to sneak in and go, yeah, I know this, but just so they know, why don't you explain it again? It's just one of the greatest perks of the job. You get to work with very nice people that are willing to help you out, that are willing to come in and, you know, teach you. Emergency medicine is lifelong learning. So thanks, Allie.
No problem. Thank you.
So we're going to go to ASAP. We're not going to have much to talk about from ASAP, I hope. At least not on the podcast.
I don't know. I won't be there. I'm just going to be laughing at pictures of you guys later, I think.
Aw, that's sad. All right. So Anna Waterbrook, our Associate Residency Director at South Campus, is going to give us an update on what's been going on for South Campus conferences. She's gracious enough to do this in the middle of an attending-only shift. So when you see her, give her a great big hug. So Anna, what's been going on, stuff that if you are on university campus, you'd want to go watch on Panopto, or if you're on South Campus and you missed it, not that any of your residents would ever miss a conference, but what stuff that they should go back and check up on? What's some of the highlights of what's been going on this month?
So I think a couple of the highlights actually from this month are not on Panopto. So if you snoozed, you've lost. No, not really. But you know, I think one of the highlights is that we completed our first asynchronous learning block, and we're actually doing asynchronous learning with narrative medicine. And we recently finished reading the book Better by Atul Gawande. It's a great book, and basically it's just as the name states, it's really about how you can be better in our profession, how you can improve your performance, and each chapter is sort of an anecdote of different stories about various patients and or public health problems that he has encountered, and he sums it all up really nicely at the end. It's if it's not a book you've read, but it's something that you're interested in general, it's actually a very easy read. There's big words.
Are there pictures?
There's no pictures.
All right, you lost me.
Sorry. But it's a fantastic book. So if this is at all something that you are interested in, I feel like it actually inspired me to become a better physician, and I've incorporated some of his techniques.
Very cool.
So we'll actually all be meeting in December to discuss the book, and if we'll send out a date for when we're getting together to have wine and cheese and discuss Better. And if anybody from university campus is interested in joining us, please shoot me an email, and you're more than welcome to join.
Sweet.
I think the other highlight actually from this month, so we had Sim Day, we had Pulmonary Day in the Sim Lab. Vivian, as always, does a fantastic job. You know, we did chest tubes. We learned about how to manage CHF. She's got a great summary, which I'm sure she'd be happy to send you guys. There's also a great EM wrap with a summary by Amal Matu on CHF. It was either in September or October. I don't actually remember that off the top of my head. And there was also a great pediatric sim case. And then finally, Dan Latt from orthopedics came and talked to us about the management of distal radius fractures in the ED. So we had a didactic portion. We also had a great hands-on session, which talked about, you know, the maneuvers to reduce distal radius fractures, also how to recognize whether or not it's going to be an inherently unstable versus stable fracture, and then also the importance of doing three-point bending, so that if you have performed and achieved an amazing reduction of that distal radius fracture, the last thing you want to do is send it out and gets to ortho clinic and it's dislocated again. So that is not on Panopto because we did it in the war room in the ED, but if anybody's interested, we actually sent out an article that Dan Latt sent out that basically goes through all of this, how to reduce the distal radius fractures, how to splint it. It's also very short, very readable. All the South Campus residents got it, but we would be happy to also send it out to the university campus residents.
Great. Should people email you if they're interested?
Absolutely.
Sounds good. All right. So thank you very much, Anna. We'll let you get back to your shift, and we'll be back next month to see what other awesome stuff we're doing during conference. Thank you for putting all this stuff together.
All right. Thank you.
A million ways to die.
Ah! Ah! That went south so fast! Ah!
Awesome. All right, Jared. So I got a case for you.
Can't wait.
Yeah, you stumped me last time, so now I've got quite the case.
Yeah, I spent all month worrying about what this.
You should be. So, This is one of those ones you just can't make up. Like, if I made this one up, you'd think I was a complete liar, and you'd say, find all holes in it. This actually happened. So, 18-year-old male, he's a T4 paraplegic, and he comes in to room 45 in the pediatric ED, and the nurses say, you got to come see this kid. He looks terrible. So you walk in the room, and there's this African-American kid, T4 paraplegic. He's lying there with his head slumped over the left-hand side, very tachypneic, increased work of breathing, not really all that interactive, but can answer a few questions. You look up on the monitor, and the very first thing you see when you look up on the monitor is his vital signs. Heart rate is 139. Respiratory rate comes up at about 24. Blood pressure is 74 over 28. And pulse ox, tough to tell if it's really picking up, but it says 56%. Kid's not quite on oxygen. So you talk to mom briefly. She goes, yeah, he's been sick for a couple of days. He just had that wound on his backside, debrided a couple weeks ago. But he's, you know, it seems like it's kind of smelling bad again. I don't really like the way it looks. And hey, he's just been feeling more and more dizzy, so we decided it's probably time to bring him in. So what's your approach to this kid?
I would call a PGM doctor to come see him.
We are all out. We're all somewhere playing in a playground.
I would approach it similar to your tachycardic patient with tamponade that you stumped me with a couple months ago. I would say, is this a heart problem or is it a vessel problem? And based on the blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure of 28, I would say, and a relative wide pulse pressure, I would say this is probably a blood vessel problem, meaning he has some kind of vasodilatory state. Given his paraplegia and chronic wound, he's most likely septic from that. But I would say he has a vasodilatory state. Now, the hypoxemia is an interesting one. So it, does he have hypoxemia because his cardiac output is so high that his mixed venous is low and he can't oxygenate? Does he have pneumonia? Does he have some kind of shunt? Those are the things that I would approach. And the best way to do that, I would say, is with ultrasound.
Okay. So we're trying to get the ultrasound in the trauma bay, all five of them, you know, because they're never in the PZD when I want them there.
Yeah.
Hint, hint, Shrikar. So we're trying to get everything set. What's your approach to this patient? What kind of orders are you barking out, and what are you preparing for this kid?
You know, the first thing is he needs to be oxygenated better, because no matter what you try to do with him, if you don't get his sats up, things are going to be a problem. And plus, it'll be really telling if you try to give him oxygen and his sats don't budge. That'll be telling that he's got a shunt physiology.
Okay.
The other thing is, you're telling me the guy's got altered mental status. He's going to need to be intubated for several reasons, right? He's got altered mental status. He's hypoxemic. He's septic. All those things point to he probably needs invasive airway management. But you don't want to do that with a sat of 50 and a blood pressure of 70 over 28. So I would ask for to start pre-oxygenating him however you choose you want to do that. If you think he's got pneumonia, maybe non-invasive. If you think he's got shunt from that. And then I'd want two good IVs, and I probably would start hanging a pressor on him based on his vasodilatory state.
Okay.
Does he have edema?
He doesn't have edema anywhere. No, you look, he's a really skinny kid. He's got lots of muscle atrophy from being a T4 paraplegic and doesn't really seem to have any edema anywhere. So we kind of came to the same conclusion on this kid just from the 5-second view of this kid is septic. When we probably have a source in the sense that he's got a D-cube. Is he seeding from his D-cube? Does he have endocarditis? Does he have pneumonia? We didn't really know, but obviously this is a sick kid. So we did
a murmur or anything like that?
No, we didn't hear a murmur when we listened to him. So we're kind of going through and trying to figure out what's going on, and he has we start to put him on oxygen, we start to give him some fluids, and we start to treat him as septic shock. So we're going to take a break real quick from the case to talk about septic shock. Those of you that haven't been under a rock for a while, there's this new paper called the ARISE trial. So the ARISE trial is goal-directed resuscitation for patients with early septic shock. They are trying to re-implement early goal-directed therapy in a different setting, multiple centers instead of the single center, and they wanted to see what was going on. So for those of you that haven't read this paper, this is in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is published this month, e-published ahead of time. And everybody's talking about this because this has been a hot-button issue since 2001, when Manny Rivers did his paper in the New England Journal of early goal-directed therapy. So, Jared, just for a little background, what is the problem that Manny Rivers was trying to approach by doing his paper? What was the issue we had with sepsis?
Well, the issue we had that was the mortality was sky high. If you were septic in 1998 or 1999, you had a 50% chance of dying if you had severe sepsis or septic shock. And places were busy and nobody really knew how to approach seeing those patients. There was almost, not unlike the situation we have now, where there was some people who were saying, well, let's just throw them on pressors and send them upstairs or put them in the corner. And there were other people saying, no, we need to flood them with fluid. And there really wasn't a systematic way to approach those patients. And so Manny and his crew, they had a nine bed unit in the emergency department that was staffed with one attending, two residents, and three nurses at all times, and they tried to say, how can we systematically approach these patients?
And one Bernie Knobloch.
Oblige me for a second, and let me just back up, and let me start with the Rivers trial. So the Rivers trial was over a three-year period. They enrolled patients, 1997 to the year 2000. And the criteria were patients with two SIRS criteria plus hypotension after fluids or a lactate greater than 4, evidence of hypoperfusion, okay? And if you look at it carefully, it was really an SVO2 trial. And the reason I say that, so they had 288 patients that they screened and ended up enrolling 263, so roughly 130 patients per group. And if you do the math on the patients per month, that's about 7.3 patients per month over the three-year period. Now, one thing to take note is currently the global incidence, and you have to take that with a grain of salt because incidence depends on the definition. And so if you change the definition of severe sepsis, then the incidence changes. But currently the incidence of severe sepsis is about 300 per 100,000. So if you take a 100,000 visit a year ED like Henry Ford, you're going to see roughly 300 patients per year who meet that criteria. And that's about 25 patients per month. So they enrolled about a third of that, 7 patients per month. So you keep that in mind as we talk about these other trials. And what they did was they randomized these people to either usual care or early goal-directed therapy. Now, usual care was a CVP goal, a MAP goal, a urine output goal. And then they went upstairs, quote-unquote, as soon as possible, is what they say in the paper. If they got early goal-directed therapy, it was all those same things, except they got an SVO2 target with transfusions, hematocrit goal, cardiac index with dobutamine, so on and so forth. And they stayed in the emergency department for at least 6 hours. Now, interestingly, they note that the early goal-directed therapy patients stayed in the ED longer, 8 hours versus 6.3 hours, but the trial was designed that way. Okay, and so the time from arrival to the ED to the time of enrollment was about 1.5 hours. And I think that's an important number to keep in mind, 1.5 hours. The baseline lactate was between 7 and 8, and their albumin was 2.8. And the average Apache 2 score was 20 to 21. So I think those numbers are also important to keep in mind. So enrolled, average time, 1.5 hours from time of arrival to the emergency department. Baseline lactate, 7 to 8. Albumin was 2.8. So these patients were sick at baseline. And their Apache 2 score was 20 to 21. And the standard group's in-hospital mortality was 46%. It's egregiously high. And the early goal-directed therapy group was 30.5%, and they got on average 5 liters of fluid compared to 3.5 liters of fluid for the standard group. Now, if you think about that, that is amazing. It was 16% mortality difference in just this one little, just manage SVO2, give them dobutamine and blood and whatnot to an SVO2 target. You know, you clear their lactate quicker. And bam, it was published in the New England Journal and Critical Care Medicine at the same time, and it sparked what we know now and love today as the Surviving Sepsis Campaign.
One of the criticisms of the paper was that the mortality rate was so high.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a function of Detroit, because I've never been there. I don't know if that's a function of the state of sepsis at that time. But this is one of the critiques that you'll probably talk about later, of the mortality rate in any sepsis study since this one has never really been as high as this one. That's one of the things when you talk about the difference in mortality. Well, the mortality rate was exceedingly high. You say egregiously high. What do you think about that when we've tried to replicate some of these?
So I think there's a couple things. One is, you know, like I mentioned, the incidence is roughly 25 patients per month, and they enrolled about 7 patients per month. So did they get an accurate snapshot of the global perspective of what we see today? I don't know. Is it Detroit? I don't know. Or is it just...
Say my name.
You know, the Heisenberg principle, where you observe a system and you inherently change that system.
You're right.
I think all those things probably factor into it. But the reason, for this exact reason that we're having this conversation now, is the reason why these three new trials were immediately planned. So the three trials were the PROCESS trial, which came out last year, the ARISE trial, which came out last week, and then the PROMISE trial, which is going to come out sometime this year.
So just as a recap, so PROCESS trial was United States.
Yeah.
The ARISE trial was Australasia, yeah. So kind of Australia, New Zealand kind of areas. And where's the PROMISE trial?
Europe.
Europe. Okay. So these are not one city. These are large, multi-center trials, which is ideally what you'd like.
There was a lot of criticism with the Rivers trial of, well, you know, it was really a proof of concept study. It was 130 patients per group. It's one center, one site, one investigator. They had a dedicated team. And there were some questions that were brought up about maybe not disclosing a relationship with Edwards for the catheter. And I think all that stuff's irrelevant. I think these guys, well-respected, showed a massive mortality improvement with their intervention that was an early and aggressive intervention for sepsis and septic shock at their hospital. So these three other investigative groups decided that they were going to try to replicate this in a prospective fashion, in a multi-center fashion, and try to answer this once and for all. So fast forward from the period 1997 to 2000 to last year when the PROCESS trial was published. So the PROCESS trial was 31 hospitals over a six-year period. And if you do the math, they had 1,341 patients. That's about 22 patients per month. So getting closer to the global perspective of incidence. They had the same criteria, only the patients had to be enrolled within 2 hours of detection of meeting criteria and 12 hours from arrival to the emergency department. And they got randomized to either early goal-directed therapy, a protocol standard protocol, and then a standard therapy. And you can imagine the inherent criticism right away is, well, standard therapy is probably going to be biased by early goal-directed therapy, right? So we'll talk about that. So if they got randomized to early goal-directed therapy or the standard protocol, they got a dedicated team, which was one physician, one coordinator, and one nurse. Early goal-directed therapy was obviously early goal-directed therapy. The protocol, or the standard protocol, was they had adequate peripheral IV access, and they got fluids and pressors for systolic blood pressure and a shock index, and then they got transfused if the hemoglobin was less than 7.5. If they got randomized to the standard therapy, they had no dedicated team. It was just anybody took care of them. Okay, so the baseline characteristics are fairly interesting. They had more patients with intra-abdominal infection compared to the Rivers trial, and they had less patients with quote-unquote other infections than the Rivers trial. But where it gets really interesting is the criticism with this trial was that the patients weren't as sick as the Rivers patients, but it's probably not true because the baseline Apache was the same as the Rivers trial, same at 72 hours as well. The heart rate was the same. The MAP was actually lower than in the Rivers trial, and the pH was the same, and the creatinine were the same as the Rivers trial. So what does that say to me? Well, you add that on top of the fact that their time to randomization was longer. They averaged 3 to 3.5 hours compared to 1.5 hours for early goal-directed therapy. So what would you take? How would you interpret that?
So it sounds like they're sicker. They're probably left to languish a little bit more, and it seems like they're pretty accurate, if not a sicker population than the EGD therapy.
Or are they coming in earlier?
Yeah.
Are they coming in earlier, so it's taking a little bit longer for them to trigger those criteria? their baseline lactate was lower. It was around 5 compared to the Rivers trial. And the protocol standard group received most of their fluids early. And interestingly, they had acute renal failure more often than the early goal-directed therapy group. Now, this was an important point. So why would they have, if they got more fluid earlier, got reperfused sooner, why would they have more acute renal failure? Most of their fluid came in the first couple hours, and this is a complete side note, but I don't know if it's noise or if there's a signal there. And what I would imagine is that there's some talk recently about one of the reasons why people get acute renal failure with fluid resuscitation is that the kidney is a capsulated organ. And if you flood that with a bunch of fluid, you're going to create renal compartment syndrome. And so did that happen? Is that the reason why we have this signal here with these patients? I honestly don't know the answer to that. But it's something to keep in mind. So the standard therapy had similar fluids and dobutamine compared to the Rivers standard group, not the early goal-directed therapy group. So all the people who say, well, standard therapy was just like early goal-directed therapy, it was more like the usual care in the Rivers trial. And the early goal-directed therapy group got about 2 liters less than the Rivers early goal-directed therapy group, but they ended up getting more, 25% more vasopressors. So what do you think about that? How do you interpret that? Do you say, okay, question's answered to me, or do you say, I need more data?
You know, I think that it's a multi-center trial now, so it's not just the one center. I think that you've now got two competing articles, and I still think it's very difficult to say that standard therapy has no relation to early goal-directed therapy. That's like saying that none of the competitor smartphones have anything to do with the iPhone. You know, you come out with something that's groundbreaking, it's hard to ignore any aspect of it and say, no, this is exactly what we used to do when we have flip phones. It's actually closer to a flip phone. Well, it's not. They're all closer to iPhones. Right. So I think it's hard to completely ignore it, but I think that they're very similar populations, and I think that they're, what you describe is that they're very close to the study that Rivers did. Usual care is kind of hard to argue, but I think that it's a pretty good study to say that every component of Rivers protocol is not necessarily necessary for every patient.
Yeah, the way I interpreted it was the same as you. I interpreted it as, let's just say that early goal-directed therapy has had the effect that was intended by making it the Surviving Sepsis campaign and whatnot, and that it elevated the level of care for quote-unquote usual care. I think that's fantastic. And now you have a study that has elevated usual care, and it turns out that only about 50% of those patients, so the usual care, they got central lines 50% of the time, 57% of the time, and they only got an SVO2 checked 4% of the time. So it was really closer to the standard care for early goal-directed therapy. But I think, let's just say that most of those patients got their SVO2 checked as a spot check or whatever. Great. Because now you're telling me that there's no mortality difference between early goal-directed therapy and usual care. So to me, I think it's early and aggressive that makes the difference, not the actual endpoints.
Yeah, I think the important thing is to not discount the fact that early goal-directed therapy in that word is important. You need to have early therapy. You need to have some goal that you're trying to hit instead of, I don't know, give them another 500 of fluids. Just start them on dopamine, right. Throw some Levofed at them. They're almost gone. Might as well try some Levofed. It's the early recognition. Now, EGT copyright Manny Rivers may not be the way that every patient needs to be treated, but it gets the word out of, we need to figure this out. We need to recognize it, resuscitate these patients fast. And one of the things I thought most interesting in the ARISE trial, you mentioned that in the Rivers patients, the early goal-directed therapy patients stayed longer in the ED. In the ARISE trial, they got out of the ED an hour and a half sooner than the usual care patients. So having a plan not only resuscitates the patients well, leads to a still good outcome, it gets them out of the ED faster. So
personally, I do think that after two of these trials, and you'll talk a little bit more out of about ARISE, I think SVO2 is kind of dead. I don't think that it's necessarily something that we need to aggressively pursue in the ED, and I think that the specific catheters aren't important in the initial resuscitation in the ED, now shown in two multi-center trials. But I do think that having any kind of a game plan that makes physiologic sense is better than no game plan, which is what we used to do.
Yeah, you get idiots like me who sit there and harp on, well, you need to check a lactate, you need to check an SVO2, and you do it every 2 hours and see where you're going. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I need to check it when they get to the ICU. Maybe you need to check it if they're going to hang out in the ED for 8 to 10 hours. Maybe after 6 hours, you check it and see where you are. But maybe up front, you don't need to do that. And the critics of this are all fearful that we're just going to degenerate back into trying to start fire by banging rocks together. And my response to that is, can we just give each other a little bit more credit than that and say that that ship has sailed, we're going to be more thoughtful. So now fast forward to the ARISE trial. So the ARISE trial was now 51 hospitals over 67 months, 2008 to 2014, over a six-year period, 1,600 patients. Do the math, that's 24 patients per month. So very close to the global snapshot of incidents that we have. Now, it's a little unfair because if you look in the supplemental material, most of those patients were enrolled in the later years. So they got enrolled, same criteria. They had to be enrolled within 6 hours compared to 12 hours of the process trial, and they had to be randomized within 2 hours of being enrolled. And they either got early goal-directed therapy, in which they had a dedicated team that decided where they wanted to have that patient, whether it was in the emergency department or the ICU. It didn't have to be stay in the ED for X amount of time. They could go wherever. Or they got usual care, which was no dedicated team. And, you know, one thing I think is important here, I keep mentioning if they had a dedicated team or not, you know, we talk about the targeted temperature versus therapeutic hypothermia, and one thing we keep mentioning is, well, those patients have a dedicated doctor and a dedicated nurse. And here you have a situation where early goal-directed therapy is more aggressive, they have a dedicated team, but it's not any better than usual care who doesn't have a dedicated team. So I think that's important to point out. And their time to randomization was 2.8 hours longer than both the RIVERS and the PROCESS trial. So how do I interpret that? I think they're coming in even earlier. Mm-hmm. Their total volume was around 2 liters, give or take a liter and a half, versus 1.7 liters, give or take a liter and a half. So everything you see, every one of these trials that comes out is a little bit less fluid, right? They don't need 6 liters of fluid. 2 liters is okay. And their baseline characteristics were they had lower long-term care facility patients, which is interesting, and they had a lower comorbidity index than both of the previous trials, also interesting. So the patients probably weren't as baseline sick chronically. Their patients had more dobutamine than the other trials, and they had a lower mortality than the RIVERS, but pretty close to the PROCESS trial. And their length of stay, like you mentioned, was a little bit longer for the usual care versus early goal-directed therapy. So, interestingly, the same week in Critical Care Medicine was another paper that was published that was from titled Interaction Between Fluids and Vasoactive Agents on Mortality and Septic Shock. Okay, it was a retrospective study, 24 hospitals in 3 different countries. And it was about 3,000 patients with septic shock. And what they did was they looked at the timing of fluids and pressors to see what the effect on mortality was. It's very apropos to this conversation, right?
Absolutely.
So my interpretation of their data was it appears that in the first 2 hours from the onset of hypotension, fluids are better. In the first hour, 1 to 9 liters was no better than 500 cc's to 1 liter of fluid. And for 1 to 6 hours, 2.5 to 13 liters was no better than 1 to 2.5 liters. And so it indicates that early fluids are good, but flooding is bad. And after about 1 to 2 hours, starting pressors is the optimal time. So the way I interpret all of these data together are that now it's consistent with the process in the ARISE trials. Now you have 82 hospitals with 3,000 patients in 2 separate regions of the world who are saying the same thing. And I think what they're saying is that early goal-directed therapy changed mortality drastically forever, but the components of it that did were early and aggressive.
Right. There were so many components in the Rivers Protocol. I remember coming in as a fourth-year medical student when this really started to hit, hit the fan as far as we all have to be doing this, and we were supposed to memorize every part of the Rivers Protocol. And there were critics on either side of, oh, you have to do this. We have to be dogmatic about it. No, actually, you can back off a little bit on this because this is my read of the paper. I think that there were so many components that we didn't really know which one was the important one. So this led to, you could have published an entire journal monthly about stuff to refute or confirm the Rivers paper. It could have been the Rivers Journal monthly to do a pro and con, because people were saying, do we really need to put a central line in every patient? Do we really need an SVO2? Do we really need to give blood? Do we really need to hang pressors for this map? What are the goals? And they nitpicked every single one of these components. And when Manny Rivers came last year and gave a grand rounds here, his thing was, I don't care what you do, just do it and do it quickly, because people are dying.
Right.
He said, I learned this from my professors that taught me, from my attendings that taught me. Physiologically, it made sense, and people just weren't doing it. They were letting people sit in the back hall. So yeah, I don't care if you use CVP or don't. I don't care if you lift people's legs up to their ears or don't, just do something and do it quickly. Don't let these people languish. So I think that that's great that now we're starting to get a little more specifics of give them quick fluids, but don't give them 6 liters and then walk away and assume that's going to be it.
Or give them nothing and put them on dopamine and let them sit in the corner.
Any of you that have done your ICU rotation and have seen these poor people that have received tons and tons of fluids that blow up like balloons, it's tough. You spend the next week or two trying to get all the fluids off of them so that you can get them diuresed and get them extubated. So I think that appropriate early aggressive fluids followed by pressors is great.
Yeah, the questions I have going forward now, I think we got to pay our respects for what early goal-directed therapy did and now move the conversation forward. I think, digging your heels in and saying, the bundle is the bundle, we need to follow it, or the bundle is dead, we can do nothing. I think those are nonsense. I think we need to move the conversation forward, because it appears that now the new baseline is 18% mortality. How do we break that? I think process of delivering care trials, like what we're seeing with Process and Arise and Promise, I don't think those are going to break that barrier. I think now when you start looking at physiologic resuscitation and different methods that maybe aren't technologically ready for prime time yet. But the other question going forward that's a process of care question is, how early is too early? We have this conversation about we need to alert every one of these patients at triage or pre-hospital, but do we? We don't really know. I think that is the next question, is how early is too early?
Yeah, this is not necessarily a STEMI or a stroke that we've got fairly well established door to balloon times, door to TPA times, you could argue. But this is something that it's still time sensitive. But I think, how do you tell when somebody's got a UTI versus pilo? At what point do you decide, oh, I'm going to treat them UTI versus pilo? It's usually a clinical decision. And I think that decision is going to be tough to figure out for a little bit. But it's nice that we're heading in that direction.
Yeah, agree.
That's a nice problem to have of, well, when is too early? Because we're now so on guard against this that we're not going to let it slip by us. So now maybe we're trying to get back to, all right, let's lighten up a little bit and be very particular so that we're appropriately implementing this from a patient care, from a patient outcome, from a even fiscal responsibility of, how are we going to implement sepsis care?
I think one thing that's scary is now we're going to have 3 trials with when the Promise comes out. It's going to be all over the world, 100 and something hospitals, thousands of patients. Now anybody that tries to have an idea going forward of, okay, these process of care trials they've hit all the low-hanging fruit. Now to break through that 18% barrier, now we need to do something innovative. How are they ever going to get that into the mainstream? It's like, well, we have 3,000 patients that show that it's early fluids and antibiotics.
So let's take all this literature. We just did 4 papers. Let's take all this literature we've discussed and apply it to this patient. 18-year-old patient, hypotensive, tachycardic, hypoxic, septic. So we get him on some oxygen. We're starting to pre-oxygenate him. You're getting airway equipment to the bedside, and he's got IV access. So what are you going to do for him?
Can I have my ultrasound now? Or
before we get to what the ultrasound shows, because you're having a hard time interpreting it, you go to look at this guy, and you pull back the sheets, and this is what his fingers look like.
Oh, very nice. He's got severe clubbing.
So if you guys look down at your phones or wherever, this will be on there. So
that's impressive.
It's impressive clubbing. So what does that mean to you in the setting of a hypoxic patient?
He has chronic hypoxemia.
Yeah.
What's his baseline?
So I turn to Mom, who is not as worried as the rest of the people in the room. I say, Mom, what's wrong with his heart? And Mom says, oh, he has pulmonary atresia.
Excellent.
I go, what happened to this poor kid? So he was born with pulmonary atresia, meaning his pulmonic valve did not form, and he had a patent ductus arteriosus and an ASD that helped support him until he could have surgery. Because this is one of the terrible T's. This is, even though it's pulmonary atresia, it's terrible pulmonary atresia. This is one of the cyanotic heart lesions. And so we start asking Mom these questions. So a clinical pearl from this is if you have a patient with congenital heart disease, you ask him a couple questions real fast. You say, what's his normal oxygen supposed to be? So that's the first thing I ask Mom. She says 65 to 80.
Nice.
Which means that his O2 sat of 57 is actually not that bad.
You flip that the other way. If you, let's say it's 65% and you go up to a sat of 100%, do you know what that does to your pulmonary blood flow?
You're going to cause vasodilation, and it's going to flood his lungs potentially. And you can have a lot of issues with kids that have this, that have certain congenital heart disease of you'll flood their lungs with too much oxygen, and they'll actually go into failure and pulmonary edema.
Yeah, if you have single ventricle physiology, which is essentially what this is, your blood flow, your QP, your blood flow to your lungs, and your blood flow to your systemic circulation, QP to QS, is based off of pulmonary vascular resistance and systemic vascular resistance. So if you were to change the pulmonary vascular resistance by going from a sat, say 85% to 100%, do the math, it turns out, if I remember correctly, it turns out that your QP to QS goes from 1 to 1 to 5 to 1, so you give them fluid pulmonary edema.
So you can actually kill some of these kids by giving them too much oxygen, which brings me back to something that I was taught a lot of. Oxygen is a drug. It's not 100% oxygen is not normal. Not everybody needs 100% oxygen. Hypoxic people need to go up. So I wrote up on the board 65 to 80% sats. Keep him there. So a whiff of oxygen got him right back up. So the first question I asked for congenital heart disease, what's his normal sat supposed to be? The second is, has he had any surgeries? So you want to look for the median sternotomy, or sometimes it's a left thoracotomy depending on what was done. You say, what surgeries has he had and how many? So you don't necessarily need to know what they all are, but you need to know how many, because there's a progression for some of these surgeries. Some of these are fixed in one stage. Some of them are fixed in three stages. And the last question is, who's your cardiologist and how do I get in touch with them? This is all the stuff that I'm wondering right now. I went from wanting to intubate this patient immediately to actually being a little bit more comfortable with where he was at. And truth be told, if I would have intubated this patient, there's a good chance I would have killed him.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for several reasons. You know, the blood flow to lungs being one reason, but the other is afterload changes on the heart. And the third reason is,
because I would have intubated him. So we find out he's got pulmonary atresia. So then I ask Mom, what is his surgery? So she says, oh, he hasn't had any surgery. And I go, that's not possible. He would never have made it to 18, let alone 18 and paraplegic. So she says, oh, well, he's got a BT shunt. So a BT shunt, to kind of back up, a BT shunt is a shunt that they did back in the 1930s, 1940s, and this is what they would do to fix kids with tetralogy of Fallot. When you've got a problem with blood going from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart, then they make a BT shunt. And if you look at the phone, look down at whatever you have, we've got a little diagram there. So what they would do with a BT shunt, traditionally is they would actually unhook the subclavian and they would hook it directly in the subclavian artery and hook it directly into the pulmonary artery to make sure that you would get blood flow. So what they've done instead is they've actually taken a Gore-Tex graft and they hook your pulmonary artery into your innominate artery so that you don't have to unhook the right side. The problem with that is that basically you now have a patent ductus which has been created for you, and that thing can clot off. So a hypoxic kid with a BT shunt is not necessarily having lung problems. They're having lung perfusion problems.
Yeah, that happened to me. My intern year, I had a one-year-old clotted off from dehydration.
So the treatment for this, it's not lytics. It's not oxygen. It's not anything other than you go directly to the OR and get your shunt fixed now. There's no other fix for this. So I'm starting to panic now. So I'm calling my consultants. I'm going through my phone and calling anybody that I ever have met that would deal with this kind of stuff. And thankfully, one of our intensivists came down to help me out. She helped me with the physiology to realize that wasn't quite what happened. What actually the kid had was he had a Glenn. So he did have a second procedure after his first shunt. So what he has is his superior vena cava is now hooked into his pulmonary artery, which means that a portion of his blood flow will go directly into his pulmonary artery and the rest of it doesn't. So he is preload dependent to the nth degree. So what happened with him is he got septic from his decubitus ulcer. He dropped his systemic vascular resistance. He got hypotensive, and that hypotension led to poor perfusion of his lung. So you know what happened with him is we bolused him a liter of fluids and his sats went up. Mm-hmm. And then we bolused him again and his sats went up. So this is the only patient I've ever had where you bolus him and the sats go up. I'm not worried about putting this guy into pulmonary edema. He needs the fluids because that's the only way that he is going to push anything into his lungs.
It's a traditional single pump and two sets of pipes, right? It's the traditional model of physiology.
So we finally get him a little squared away, and now we're at the point of, okay, he is sick. He needs a central venous access. He needs an art line, and we're getting him all set up because we're not going to be able to move him anytime soon. So we go in to put a central line. Jared, where do you like your central lines in your ICU patients?
I like them up top.
Okay. Would you put it up top on this guy?
Probably not.
Yeah. So we were asked this by the admitting team. Why'd you put in a fem line? Why didn't you put it in IJ?
Because it'd go into the pulmonary artery.
We go, that's called a swan. You don't want a swan. You want an IJ. So, or you want a central venous line for resuscitation. So we put it in his femoral vein. And then it turns out that he's actually, because he's a paraplegic, he's had DVTs in the past.
Of course he has.
And was on warfarin for a while and then got better. So now he's not on it anymore. So they said, well, let's make sure we scan his chest to look for a PE. I go, I don't think that's going to be as easy as you think. Because how many of you have ever scanned a chest for a PE and they said that the bolus timing was not right and so they can't really tell you? You want to bet that this kid's bolus timing is not going to be the same as everybody else. This was a patient that after Taylor Shekel and I, God bless you, Taylor Shekel, for taking care of this patient. Rad was there too, I think.
Of course and she was, yeah.
Poor Rad. We love you, Rad. So these two wonderful doctors helped take care of this patient. I was exhausted by the end of this shift. And I was like, I'm going home and I'm going to trade out the next couple shifts because I need to mentally recuperate. I build critical care time for the time I spent not sleeping that night. But this is more thought than I've ever wanted to put into any patient. And thankfully, he did very, very well. And he was in the ICU for a while, had to get his decubitus ulcer debrided a few times, got over his sepsis, and eventually went home. But this is in a long list of patients, and we may actually do a segment about this, of when intubation kills, that doing a full physical exam, some of that weird stuff you learn from medical school can actually save someone's life. And because Taylor recognized it, I recognized it, we go, this kid actually has a heart lesion or has chronic lung issues. We went in a drastically different direction, and we're able to treat this patient pretty well. So I don't think that this is typically who the ARISE or Rivers trial was shooting for, but it's sepsis nonetheless. It's just sepsis with a twist.
It's a fantastic case.
I hope I never have another one like that again.
So last month, our peer reviewer, Brian Drummond, made fun of Jared and I for always being so nervous and always talking about being so afraid. Brian, hopefully after this case, you've adopted your own set of diapers. I highly recommend Huggies as they snugly fit and they don't chafe. So what do you do if you are driving down the freeway and you see an accident on the side of the road? If you're anything like me or everybody else, you slow down to 10 miles an hour, gawk at it, and then maybe keep driving. But let's say that there's not a crew of people there. Let's say there is a crew of people there. What do you do? Because if you're highly trained emergency medicine skills, when you've got an emergency that's outside the emergency department. Well, we asked Ryan Wyatt, who's one of our paramedics, exactly that question, and he had a great discussion. So I have Ryan Wyatt here. He's one of our paramedics. He works at University Campus. He works at South Campus. He works a lot of places. And he's got quite a bit of experience when it comes to pre-hospital medicine, both civilian and military. So, Ryan, I wanted to see if, because I'm not going to get all of the stuff that you've done, if you could give us a quick idea of your training and kind of your preparation to make you such a credentialed person to give this talk.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me here today, Aaron. My name's Ryan, and I've been a medic for about 21 years. Started in the military as a Navy medic, then as a civilian medic, started out in PEDS in private practice, and then went over, was a flight medic here in Arizona. I'm still a flight medic here in Arizona. Was a combat medic with Dying Corps in Blackwater in Iraq for the last 4.5 years, running medevac for Department of State. And I work here at University at the Trauma Center and at South Campus and teach the paramedic program at Pima.
So you've seen a few sick patients?
A few.
Okay. So what I asked Ryan to talk to us about today was, what do we do when we're outside of the ER? And he's got experience outside of the ER. He's worked in lots of situations that don't have all the stuff that we have. We have a lot of interns, lots of residents, people that just have their new medical license. They can't wait to go use it. And oftentimes, when you have doctors that are out in the field and something happens, we kind of lose our wherewithal of what's going on because we don't have everything at our disposal like we usually do. So I wanted to talk a little bit with you about what should we do and what should we have, what should our response be when we have something bad happen that's out in the field. So just as a general thought, and then I'll give you a few cases, what should us emergency doctors, residents, attendings, what do you think that we have to offer to a patient that's critical in the field?
Well, the first thing you have to offer is, ask them about that life-saving tetanus shot. beyond that, the best thing, the best approach would be what you learned in the beginning of medical school, purely ABCs. If you can manage that appropriately, and you can always manage that with the least amount of equipment, that doesn't even have to be invasive. So that's where I would start. But let's back up a little bit. Scene safety is paramount. It's driven home to us. It's the first thing, my safety first, your safety as my team member, and then the victim last. So make sure, first of all, you park your car in a safe spot. Get off the side of the road. If you have flashers, turn them on, but angle your car to protect you against being struck by another vehicle. The basics, once again, so gloves. Make sure you have a pair of gloves wherever you go. With Ebola and everything else going on, you don't want to expose yourself unnecessarily. And then just start with the ABCs. Make sure they're not any life threats. If the car's on fire, pull them out. If it's not, maybe the best thing to do is leave them in the car for C-spine issues. And wait for EMS to arrive, which means call 911 right away.
So I'll give you a case. So let's say that we are, I'm a doc, I'm just driving to Phoenix down I-10, and I come upon ahead of me a car that's over on the side of the road, flipped over, no one else around, I'm the first one to find it. What's an appropriate response?
Well, the first thing to do to get the ball rolling, dial 911. Get help. As fast as you can. There's parts in Phoenix that's no man's land, and the first person that may arrive on scene may even be a helicopter. So get 911 rolling. And then, you know, cautiously approach. Put your gloves on and have maintained your situational awareness. Watch the vehicles, you know, coming down the road as well, and make sure you're safe. And then call out. See if the victim can respond. That would be in the first thing to do, that would be immediate triage. You know, we don't know how many victims there are. You know, you may have three hands raised up from that are scattered all over the brush and everything. So do your fast triage, identify the number of victims, and then go to town. Do what you guys do best.
We do this very infrequently, where we have to triage patients in the ED. Usually they are prepackaged by our medics and ready to go. We're not diving into canals and digging bodies off the bottom of the water. We've got them, when they come into the ED, packaged with the glucose and vitals. And so this is something that doesn't come very natural to us as emergency docs. But we do know what we're doing. We just need to make sure that we don't do more than we are able to. So I'll give you the next scenario is, let's say we're driving down the same road. We've already helped that last person. They were fine. And we come upon another wreck, overturned car. Now there is a police car there. That's it. Police car's got the lights on. Just an officer out there. Pull over, help out.
I'd say absolutely. Identify yourself first and foremost to the police officer. Don't just walk up on scene because you could get shot.
It's a good way to get shot.
Yeah. And then you're the victim. Identify who you are. The nice thing about all police cruisers in the state of Arizona is they carry a blowout kit. And if you don't happen to have anything because you just used it on that person 5 miles down the road, ask to use their blowout kit. They have gloves, tourniquets, blood-stopping materials, combat gauze, stuff like that. So that might be to your advantage if you know how to use it.
So the last scenario is we're driving down, there's a third car that's now overturned, and there's an engine and there's an ambulance out there. Five medics are loading the person up on the backboard, and I jump out, still wearing my white coat because, you know, I'm just that kind of guy, and I walk up onto the scene. How am I going to be greeted?
They're going to look at you cross-eyed. My suggestion would be just keep on going. I've actually had this happen before, where we had a physician. He happened to be a podiatrist.
Oh.
And it was very interesting. Luckily, the person didn't have any foot trauma. And we actually have a physician on scene card that everybody carries with them, all the medics carry with them, that basically will let you know, if you decide to intervene, that we have our own set of protocols and who we work for as our medical director. And if you want to intercede in that and change anything, well, you just were pretty much handcuffed to the patient. And you have to write in with us and then stand in front of our medical director and explain why our protocol was deviated. I've never had a physician take me up on that so far.
So essentially, if we decide that we want to direct care to the paramedic team, the pre-hospital team, we have assumed care of that patient under our license, under our responsibility, and we cannot abandon that patient until they've been transitioned to another provider.
That is absolutely correct. You guys are the higher level of care. So if you actually...
Are we really?
Well,
in that scene?
According to the law, you are. But in reality, the best thing to do, if there's medics on scene, just drive by. Usually we have it under control, and that actually may delay care, and you don't want to be responsible for that.
Well, I've kind of developed the mindset that I don't work out in the pre-hospital field, and I have a lot of respect for what the pre-hospital people do. So if there's anything I can help out with, great. But otherwise, if you tell me to get moving, I'm not going to get my feelings hurt. So.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, do what your wallet can handle. We have the Good Samaritan Law in Arizona, as all states do, and it does protect you against any civil liability for anything that you do, provided that you act within a reasonable, prudent manner, and there's no gross negligence, and you stay within your scope of practice.
Now, what about the opposite? Are there any times where, because you are a medical provider, you should stop? Well, let's say that I came upon that first car, there's an overturned car, and I go, I really got to make it to my tea time, so I'm just going to keep driving. Any problems with that?
Ethically, you could say yes or no. That's very it's a very good debate. You are under no obligation to stop in the state of Arizona. And you have to assume that every time you do stop, you are putting yourself at some sort of risk, either being a pedestrian struck. A lot of people hone in on code lights and flashers, and it's like a magnet, and they drive right into the back of your car. So you have to assume what the risk is real. If the patient's standing up on the side of the road dusting themselves off, you're probably pretty good to just keep going. But if they're unconscious, unresponsive on the side of the road, their body completely angulated, I'm going to stop every time. I know what the Good Samaritan law is. I've done this on the plane twice, traveling back to Baghdad, treated two people on the plane, and we actually have a Good Samaritan law in the air that was started in 1978 to protect us at 48,000 feet.
I've stopped the last time I went to ASAP, some guy started having trouble breathing, needing some oxygen on the plane, and they asked if there were any physicians, and so I was a little cautious, but I was like, okay, I can do this. And I swear the guy probably threw a PE, but he was fine. They didn't ask if I wanted to land the plane. They gave me a little Fisher-Price stethoscope that they carry there, and he did fine, but then afterwards they said, can I see your license? And I go, yeah, and I gave my driver's license, and they go, no, your other license. Oh, okay. So, they're very cautious about that in the air as well. And you can argue you have even less equipment in the air than you would just driving with whatever you happen to have in your car.
Yeah, in the States, they have a basic medical kit. The international flights are awesome. I mean, they have everything that you can imagine. RSI, oxygen, fiber optic, intubation handles, the whole deal. However, they do need a copy of your license. And the good news is they always have a 24-hour doc. So I went up to first class, talked to the doc on the phone at 48,000 feet. I certainly didn't want to turn the plane around because then everybody's going to look at you and you may become the next victim on the plane.
Nice. All right. So it sounds like if we are out someplace outside of the ED, we know BLS, and BLS is what saves lives.
Correct.
So first thing we do, protect ourselves, look at the scene, and then do our baby, are you okay? You call 911, and then go through our ABCs.
Absolutely. That's the best thing to do overall. Starting a line out in the field usually doesn't save lives. Wait for the medics to arrive. Sometimes a patient doesn't even need half the stuff we do to them. So, protect yourself.
I made fun of Jared because he had a little portable GlideScope that he would carry around with him. I go, what, do you have ET tubes too? He goes, yeah, of course. I go, do you have oxygen in an ambu bag? You're going to blow into the ET tube.
What do you say to that one?
he has the ambu bag. I'm like, all right, it's a little room air recess, which is pretty much what you would do with just a bag mask.
Yeah.
I give Jared a hard time anytime I can.
So
when it comes down to it, let's say we're going hiking. Let's say we're just kind of driving around in our car. For physicians, well, let me ask you first. What do you carry in your car?
I don't think our podcast is long enough to do this, but I carry the full gamut. It's because I do a lot of stuff out in the desert. So I carry intubation equipment and oxygen and combat gauze and tourniquets, everything that more than I have in my helicopter.
You got a mobile clinic.
I do. However, I don't recommend everybody does that. I think the basics are the basics. Gloves. Definitely a tourniquet. There's multiple uses for that. Even some safety pins is a good thing. I have that in all my vehicles, in my wife's car. With a fractured arm, you can safety pin it right to their chest and immobilize their arm with a safety pin. So you can put together sutures that way, suture skin right away. You certainly don't have lidocaine and want to be doing any type of good, detailed procedure out in the middle of the desert. So gloves, tourniquet, some gauze, tape. Tape's always a good thing, and a good flashlight.
I find Coban to be useful for all kinds of things. I love Coban personally. And the only other question I had, 14-gauge needle for those unlikely needle decompressions?
Absolutely. If you do it, I would say have a 14-gauge for decompression only, not to put in people's arms.
Nice. Compared to what you have, it sounds like we got pretty stripped down. It's mostly hemorrhage control. It's mostly immobilization. This is pretty basic first aid stuff. Now, you are married to one of our attendings, Allison Lane. What do you let her do when you pull over to the side of the road to start your mobile ICU?
Well, we've actually had this talk a couple times, and we had an event up in Mesa, and before I even let her out of the car, I told her the only thing you're doing is holding C-spine. And she's good with that. She doesn't want to do anything else because she doesn't want to have to do the chart and epic later on.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I think this is great because it's, you know, having all of this stuff that we do in the ER, we do some really fun stuff and we feel like we're unstoppable when you're in the emergency department. And we step outside of those automatic doors and we go, uh-oh, there's a whole lot of stuff. There's babies that need delivering. There's people that are passing out that are undifferentiated. And I don't have any of my tools. So it's good to know the stripped down basics of what we can do to help people and then really start the EMS system as quickly as possible.
Absolutely. It's the best thing you can do. You know, you can make the determination when you call 911 if you're out in rural Arizona if the helicopter may be the best solution for you to get EMS out there the quickest, and especially if it's one patient, you know, and get them off scene. So I've actually had to do that before on 79 between here and Phoenix, and we had 19 people in a rollover group that was running from Border Patrol, and we landed 10 helicopters on that scene that day.
Wow. All right. Well, I hope I don't have to do that on my drive home. Ryan, thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll have you back on to talk about other cool stuff later.
You got it.
So the people you get to meet hanging out down here in the ED on Attending Tuesday. So Brad Dreyfus, in preparation for some awesomeness, just finished his PPE training and showed me an awesome picture of him doffed and donned. I can't remember which is which, but
I think it's donned and then doffed. But whatevs.
So Brad, what do you? You're not going to be here for a little while. What are you going to be doing?
So I'm going to be taking off to ASAP and then directly from ASAP heading to Ethiopia for the African Conference of Emergency Medicine, which is an amazing event where different programs from around the African continent are coming together and talking about emergency medicine. Similar to ASAP, it's grown significantly in the last 5 years, thanks to Lee Wallace and Terry Reynolds and the rest of the AFM crew. So that's super exciting. And then we'll be heading to Uganda to work with Global Emergency Care Collaborative, which I've been working with for about 5 years and help run, where we're doing capacity development for mid-level providers in emergency care and working on expanding the program. We have about 30,000 patient visits so far, and that's from one small ED, and looking to expand that out, showing that emergency medicine is truly health system strengthening and in itself a public health intervention in improving morbidity and mortality.
This is fantastic. So how much of what we do here in the States do you bring over there? Do you even try to do? How much are they able to do when you actually go over and get to help run this?
So honestly, our emergency care practitioners are nurses that were training to essentially be nurse practitioners, and they functioned essentially at a probably second-year resident level at the end of the training, and then they are also teaching the next class. So it's a two-year program. First year is essentially set up like a residency program in that they are working full-time in the emergency department as well as having didactics, and then the second year they are learning to teach more effectively. So it's a pretty fantastically sustainable program, and it's being taken over more and more by the Ugandans.
Very cool. Do you ever take residents with you?
I do. We've had several residents rotate with us, some of which now, Emily Grover actually was an EMPEDS resident who rotated with us several times, and now thankfully helped run our SIM program and SIM education curriculum development.
She actually developed kind of a modified PALS the second time she went out there.
So she realized she saw a gap in what she could fill with some knowledge and SIM training. She was excited about SIM. She took apples and PALS and kind of meshed them all together and made it contextually appropriate, and then trialed it in her second visit.
Super cool.
She just got back from her third, so hopefully she'll keep at it.
So anybody else interested in going, drop Brad a line. Probably a little bit too late to jump on this time, but
it is.
Maybe for next year.
And people can go independently as long as there is a board-certified attending there. We've got probably about 9 to 12-month lead time just because Global Emergency Care Collaborative is now diffused throughout the United States. So essentially we have residents coming from all over, and people are reserving rotations and applying and getting accepted earlier and earlier. So if you're thinking about it, drop me a line about 9 months in advance.
Very cool. All right. Good luck, Brad. We'll see you when you get back.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween to all my ghouls and goblins out there. Glad to be back. This is Brian doing a little peer review. Glad I can do some tricks and treats again this month. And Aaron and Jared gave us a good case, and we'll talk about some scene safety as well. The first case Aaron and Jared had was a septic congenital heart disease in a young 18-year-old male. Now, this is a good case because you see about two or three of these as shifts, so you need to be quite proficient in the care of these patients. But I do appreciate Jared and Aaron bringing up this case because it really gave me a chance to catch up on some sleep I've been missing, so thank you guys. But let's talk some more pathophysiology. So I'd like to introduce a kind of a lesser known curve. It's a cousin of the Frank Starling curve. It's known as the Betty Mockingbird. And it has an X and a Y axis, just like the Frank Starling. On the X axis is knowledge. And on the Y axis is effective patient care. And so you'll see in this curve, as your knowledge starts to increase, so does your effective care, and then you reach a point of diminishing returns. So I think all of us need to have more knowledge. No, I'm just kidding. I think Aaron and Jared are really peaking on theirs, so we just can't give any more knowledge, which is okay. So the second pathophys point I want to bring out, I'm going to need to talk to Joe the plumber, because Joe knows congenital heart disease. So, Joe, tell us about congenital heart disease.
Well, you know, Brian, there's some congenital heart diseases. It's just pipes and pumps. And so you take the pumps and you got to connect them to the pipes. And these kiddos, they don't got the pumps and the pipes go in the right spot. So sometimes I cut the pipe, sometimes I cut the putt. I'll reconnect them, and that's how it works, you know. And then they do fine, or they die, you know. That's just congenital heart disease. All right, well, thanks, Joe. I appreciate your insight in that. Lots of pictures. Pictures help with congenital heart disease. You need to know it for in-service exam, board review, and any other time. Google Images works really well. So let's get serial here. I think the first concept my takeaway from this podcast would be as simple as complex. So when I get a patient presenting like this, their vital signs are abnormal, they have a T4 paralysis, their sats are really low, but mom's not really concerned. Or if you start to get that funny-looking kid, I know that may not be politically correct anymore, or someone with a weird medical problem you've never heard of, I sit down and I ask the parents or the patient, and I said, tell me about your kid's condition. And I want them to educate me because I don't know these. I'm not really a congenital heart Jedi Knight. I am not a super smart guy who knows all the ins and outs of all the conditions and syndromes that are out there. But I do know that I can ask others for help, and parents are usually some of the best for this. Then I do a quick lookup, whether it's Google, Pepid, anything else that you think is a good source, and I do my own little knowledge dump into my brain, and then I usually discuss with the specialist at some point during the patient's care that knows this patient well and knows the ins and outs of their disease process. So by staying simple with them, you won't get too lost. So staying simple, we're going to continue on to sepsis, which Aaron and Jared did a great job discussing. I think they brought up the good trials that are relevant to all of our practice. In working at different places, I have seen different ways at which they attack sepsis and different protocol used. And I think there's such a diverse environment out there where emergency physicians practice that you have to stay up to date with the trials, but don't get too complex in your sepsis care. So to me, I think there are three keys that we could all take away from sepsis care in general. One is trying to early identify these patients. We know that if we don't early identify them, they can languish and have problems. So early identification is the key. Maybe we overcall them in triage if we see Sears criteria and concern for infection, but that's okay. We can use our physician judgment and not ramp up that care anymore, or we continue our care for sepsis. Two would be early fluid assessment, whether that's ultrasound of the IVC or other methods, and those are kind of debated.
and early antibiotics. We know that these are good, right? We know all the trials point to early fluids and early antibiotics that are appropriate seem to benefit all patients. The third thing to do with sepsis is after you've assessed the fluid status is a fluid bolus of crystalloids, 20 to 40 mils per kilogram. The kidney compartment syndrome was new to me that Jared brought up. I hadn't heard about that before. Kind of makes sense. If you put tons of fluid in a tight space, there's something going to die or get hurt. So I think a reasonable weight-based fluid bolus with reassessment, and that bolus can be given over 1 to 2 hours. That seems to be supported by the studies. And then you consider plus minus on a pressor. So those are the three things I look at: early identification, early fluid assessment and antibiotics, and then IV fluids plus or minus a pressor. And the keys that you'll see with the Manny Rivers paper and lots of trials out there on, as Aaron was alluding to, STEMI and stroke, is bringing out the key point of any time that we bring attention to a disease process and lots of resources, patients do better in that disease process. So if we were really aggressive with plantar fasciitis care and gave people intensive physical therapy and icing and we talked to them all the time and we laid hands and we gave them placebos and massages, I bet plantar fasciitis would have a decreased morbidity that would be quite impressive in a study. So I think a key takeaway with that with sepsis is you just have to think about it in these patients. And I think we've done a collective mindset in our community as well as in the medical field that sepsis is an important topic. And like Jared said, we've made a big difference. We're down to a good mortality, but we need to find another breakthrough, and that will be coming. I think questions that are still existing for me at sepsis: do I need a central line versus peripheral line? I can tell you when I was in the community, not a lot of us were doing central lines on all these patients because it takes time, but I can put in a peripheral IV real fast with my nurses, get some fluids, some antibiotics, and a lot of these patients turned around, right? We're dealing with a spectrum of disease. Now, certain patients in these trials had very high Apache scores and were sick as snot, but we're dealing with a full spectrum that we've got to be able to care for in the emergency room. And the really sick, maybe we give extra attention to, but those that are moderately sick, maybe it's that pyelo, maybe it's that early urosepsis or early pneumonia that you're concerned about, those are the ones you still have to use judicious care. So central line versus peripheral IV is still a question out there. And what is the best way to fluid assess a patient? I think that's still unanswered. Something that's easy and non-invasive is something that I like to use. And then I think another thing from early goal-directed therapy, the transfusion threshold, getting people up to a hemoglobin of 10 if your SVO2 is not at your goals. I think that's still in question because just about every critical care and article for sick patients, the transfusion threshold seems to be 7, except in this population, which physiologically it makes sense. However, it's not really bearing out in many of the studies. So another point I think Aaron and Jaron talked about was central line placement. I think fem lines are okay to use. Don't be afraid of the fem line. We used them as a primary line in our residency, and one of my fellow residents thought everyone should have a fem line. I think there's cases where you don't use a fem line, but in terms of concern for infection and increased rates of infection in patients, we saw those before we implemented our really sterile protocols, you know, full gown and full draping of the patient. In those patients, we don't see an increased infectious risk. Now, it's easier to manipulate something in the head and neck and leave their legs covered, but it's a good line. It's a safe line to use. All right, Aaron also talked to Ryan, who's a great medic, I think we all know and love. Yes, I have a man crush on Ryan because of his keys for ultrasound-guided IVs and getting everyone trained up on that, which is great. Good job, Ryan. I think being in the Navy like Ryan was, you do come on some mass casualty scenes. We do a lot of scene safety and care. And I think the big takeaways Ryan hit was, one, if you see an accident in the community, call 911, start the EMS system. They're going to be the best help for that patient. Two is scene safety. If you are not safe, there may be two patients instead of one patient, and that's never good. So make sure you're safe, not just from gasoline, fires, broken glass, off the road. All those are important things that you need to think about when you're trying to help somebody else. Third thing would be, let the medics do their job. They know this. They do this every day. They do a great job of it. So try not to get in the way is a big key. If you are going to do something and you are the only person on a scene, be a one person or multiple people, I think I would look at the START triage protocol, S-T-A-R-T. It's a very simple protocol to use. The simple things of, if you hear my voice, walk to me. That identifies your minor injuries real fast. The next thing you would assess would be breathing. You can check, oh, are you breathing? Yes or no. If you're no, reposition the airway. And if you reposition the airway and they're not doing anything, they're probably going to be dead and put them in the expectant category. But you're on, say, a single scene, repositioning the airway is probably just as good as any advanced airway equipment. Ryan had some nice keys in there with splinting for extremities as well as safety pins for other uses. The last thing, he commented on what you want to keep in your car trunk. I think all I have is a folding chair for my kids' soccer games, so I'm probably not the best equipped. But one thing to know, especially for those of us here in Arizona, anything that is rubberized, whether it's Coban, gloves, some of the tourniquets, all will melt and need to be checked frequently. Not cool if you show up on a scene to put those gloves on and they just disintegrate in your hand. Well, anyway, hope everyone had a good Halloween and you did some good trick-or-treating, not too much on the treating, and look forward to talking to you next month. Have a good one. Bye.
Well, Brian, I gotta hand it to you. That was a pretty good review, even though it pains me since I spent so much time on that case, but it was very good, so we appreciate it. Sorry again for the delay, and we pushed it right up until the last minute, but we got it out. We hope you guys enjoyed it, and November's in only a couple of hours, so we'll see you next month.